My name is Walter Altman, and today's session is on should we support or transform social structures. Perhaps I should have put the title more challenging, like should we support or transform the American system? But that's a part of the dialogue that might take place. I won't be talking directly to that, but rather trying to bring about some typology of possible models of participation by Christians in society, and then either giving support or transforming that society. And we might try to find our own place among these models which I'm going to propose. So this is the third session on a general theme of church-state relations. And then tomorrow we would be talking about religion, question, opiate for the poor, and so also on the relations of Marxism and Christianity. And on Friday, our session would be on the role exercised by the great religious bodies or churches in Latin America, Catholicism, Pentecostalism, Protestantism, and a syncretistic religion called Umbanda. And we might also come to a dialogue on the role by religious bodies in the United States, and perhaps also the question of the religious right and religious left, or however you call it. Well, today, looking for certain typology or models for giving support or transforming social structures. May I first take a few minutes on the Lutheran heritage. I myself am a Lutheran, and several of you, perhaps the majority of you, are Lutherans, so it might be worthwhile to give some consideration to that in the sense of asking ourselves whether Father Luther would be more of a kind of would be supporting given structures, or would he more be a force by what he did and his theology of transforming social structures. Well, we cannot go into detail of that. We would have to look into the time of Luther and so on, but I will choose one single aspect of Luther's theology and stances where we can kind of illustrate it. And that is very widely known that Luther, in many occasions, stressed the necessity of obeying the authorities, so the citizens to obey the authorities. And for many Lutherans, that has become kind of an absolute principle, it seems. And Luther also set a certain parallel between the fourth commandment of obeying to father and mother, and then the citizens obeying the given authorities. So that's very well known. I want to point out that is one side of Luther, and that there is another side which has been quite often neglected. We could remember, for example, that famous little booklet on secular authority, which has the significant subtitle of to what extent they should be obeyed. That subtitle is neglected very often. In fact, in the Portuguese translation in Brazil, the publishing house didn't put the subtitle at all. Or better, even worse, let's say. They just left out to what extent. So they said, secular authority, the obedience that is due, and left out the portion which said to what extent. And it's quite clear in that booklet, for example, that obedience to the authorities has a limit. For example, when questions of matters of faith or of conscience are ruled or dominated by the authorities. That's not in the realm of the secular authorities. And if the secular authorities do this, no obedience should be given. Rather, disobedience or resistance or even suffering, if necessary, or persecution, matters of faith and conscience. Well, Luther was not always consistent himself, we have to confess. One dark side of Luther is that in the 30s, for example, he called on the authorities a couple of times, or several times, to exercise repression over against the Anabaptists. So the principle of that freedom of conscience and was not always kept by Luther. We also tend to forget that side. But at the same time, we have kind of really forgotten very much, we Lutherans, a kind of a prophetic tradition and critique in Luther. You can find many occasions in his life where he stood up against the authorities, starting with that famous "Here I stand," and not retracting what he had written in face of the emperor. But in many other occasions he called people to exercise the evangelical and prophetic criticism to the authorities. One text which is very remarkable on that is an explanation on Psalm 82, which can be found in Luther's works here in the reference library, volume 13. The latter part of that explanation, again, is not that beautiful, because again it kind of comes to points where he's criticizing the Anabaptists and so on, and that their liberty should be restricted. But the first part of that explanation on Psalm 82 is very remarkable, and that is from the year 1530. So quite a few years, several years after the Peasants' War, where Luther took side with the princes when it came to an ultimate conflict. And Luther explains, we cannot go into detail now, we won't have the time, explains that Psalm 82 as a political psalm. Says that is a political psalm. And what is it political? Says, well, here the princes are being judged in the midst of the congregation. So our theme, church and state relations, here the church is suddenly the milieu in which God judges the political authorities. And the text speaks of, originally speaks of gods, but Luther, rightly so, brings about that the word actually means political authorities. So they are being judged. So the church has a critical, prophetic role over against the princes. And then he says, well, why is that necessary? We can see today, he says, that the princes, they were very glad when the Reformation movement started, when the rediscovery of the gospel came about, and the dominancy by the church over the state was criticized, and I stressed the importance of the political office, of the secular authority, and so they received that kind of message gladly. By the way, I think that was a very liberating consequence of Luther's teaching in that time, liberating the potentialities and responsibilities of public office and not being under the umbrella and dominancy of the church. But Luther was now making a point saying, well, they received, the princes, they received that message very gladly. That was a good message for them. But then they want to get rid of the gospel itself, and they want to be the gods of everything. And so they are turning everything around, and they are not recognizing that they are under God anymore, and establish themselves as gods. And therefore, the judgment is necessary, and this psalm is very necessary. And then it proceeds, verses 2, 3, and 4. We again don't have the time to go into detail. It says, well, those verses 2, 3, and 4, all those who are in public office, they should have those verses written on their desk, on their beds, on their clothes, everywhere it should be written so that they would be reminded of their task. And then he goes on and says, the first task would be to guarantee the freedom of speech, of preaching, precisely that critical preaching. They should not try to shut it down when it becomes critical, but should, that is the first task. The second one would be to defend the weak and the needy. And the third one would be to have order for the defense of the poor. Very remarkable, even the sequency when he kind of puts them before maintaining order, which we kind of remember as being good Lutheran tradition, puts before defending order to defend the rights of the poor and of the weak. That's what the state is for. And then in the next session, Luther continues to speak about who are the true preachers. And he then detects four kinds of preachers. And he says, first kind of preachers are the unfaithful and lazy ones, because they fear consequences, so they just choose the way of accommodation, and they don't criticize the authorities when it's necessary. It's much more comfortable not to do so, and in that accommodation they stay. They are the unfaithful and lazy ones. Then it said, is a second type of preachers. They are the flatterers, because they have self-interest, they want to have some advantage, they want to have a share in the privileges and so on, so they won't criticize the authorities. On the contrary, they will praise the authorities. And third, said there are the slanderers. The slanderers are those who don't have the courage to speak it out in public, but they will talk behind the back. There they will exercise the criticism. And these are not true preachers either. But the true preachers, the fourth quality, the true preachers are those who have the honesty, are faithful to God, and have the courage to speak it out publicly in worship. Therefore, Psalm 82 is that gods or the princes are being judged in the midst of the congregation. That's the place where they're being judged. And the true preachers are those who express that kind of criticism. Well, I wanted to bring out this, again saying that many of us are Lutherans, because that is a very, very neglected side of Luther. And no popular edition of Luther's writings, for example, either in English or in German or in Spanish or in Portuguese, I don't know what other languages, you will find Psalm 82, for example. That's kind of put aside, and you don't get to read it very often. But it is a remarkable text. Now, the last remark I would like to make on this first part is that if you consider the difference of times, Luther's situation and today's situation, and take into account exactly that beginning of Luther's consideration on Psalm 82, where he says, well, the princes were glad when I criticized the tutelage by the church over the political systems, but now they want to get rid of the gospel themselves and so on. What is our situation today more analogous to? And I would suggest it's much more analogous to the second situation. We don't have the real threat of a church dominating the whole society and the political system and so on, but we do have the challenge of the autonomous state that does not count on God, is not even responsible to the necessities of peoples, but has a own rationality and becomes autonomous. Therefore, if that's the case, that this is much more the situation today, or in other countries in Latin America very often, that the state kind of wants to control the church, or wants the church just to give support, but not to exercise criticism and so on, so the state is the major partner in this alliance, then those texts by Luther where he expresses criticism of the authorities become much more relevant, while the other texts which were expressing the necessity of obedience become less relevant and urgent. So this is very important, I think, for us Lutherans, how to look into political, social, economic situations today. Now I would like to move on to the second part on the typology or models. And I'm very much in debt to a German theologian on that, Ulrich Duchrow, D-U-C-H-R-O-W, Duchrow. And we don't have it here in the library. I checked. It's a publication by the Lutheran World Federation in Geneva. Church Assault or Mirror of Society. There, in the introduction, he has kind of diagrams and then brings this typology. Basically, I've made small changes in that. Well, how do Christians relate to the social, political, economic order? And I would put the several possible models as Duchrow suggests, and I see here on the board. So you could have first, let's say, models of adaptation. That means that Christians would accommodate, adapt themselves to the situation, given situation, and that could be either by a very strict model of separation of church and state, so the Christians are happy with the ecclesial and private realm and leave the public realm for the state. They might perhaps participate as citizens there, but not as Christians. So it's a kind of accommodation, and you use the model of strict separation of church and state. And as we saw at our first session, it can be either by kind of seeing the public realm as something from the devil, or you can very optimistically say that's everything is good there, but you just leave it and you accommodate yourself. Or, so that would be A, the separation of church and state. B, we saw that you could have the alliance of church and state, where both have a common project, so there is no critical tension between church and state, and both cooperate, sometimes a tension in who is, which instance is going to dictate really the goals, but nevertheless both will have the same goal, and an alliance is established between church and state. Well, I want to suggest, actually did that the first session already, that both of these possibilities here under the model of adaptation are actually not permissible for Christians. Because you lose the critical distance to the given social, political, and economic reality. A distance which, a critical distance which must be if you affirm the kingdom of God, which is different from what is present. So if you, or you could put it another way, it's not like in paradise, the original will of God with creation. So you have several ways of addressing that consciousness that Christians speak for something which is going to be different, better than what is existing. And that knowledge, that consciousness, that must be present. And the models of adaptation don't preserve that. You could perhaps say that when you separate church and state and demonize the public realm, there, of course, is a critical instance and awareness. But then you omit yourself from the responsibility for it in which God has put you as a person, as a Christian. So either you lose the critical distance or you don't assume your responsibility in the given structures. Therefore, it is my opinion that these models are really unacceptable for our Christian faith. So we have to look for a second type, not types of adaptation, but models of critical participation. Models of critical participation. And there are different ways of participating critically in given situations and structures. The first one, we move immediately to that one, the first one we could call a critical constructive participation. A critical constructive participation. That means you will have a sort of, we call it dialectics, certain tension between support, it's constructive, and at the same time it's critical. So you do exercise your criticism, a critical role, a prophetic role, but at the same time you affirm, and you probably affirm more than you criticize, because your criticism is to be constructive. So it's not supposed to change fundamentally, it's not supposed to disrupt, it's going to be constructive. So this is one possibility where you participate, you affirm things, but at the same time you do exercise a critical role. So both support and criticism is present, and therefore some change can be brought about. You don't accept the situation just like the situation is. You accept quite a bit, but there are points, there are aspects which you don't accept and you want them to be improved, and you exercise a critical role. Well, when would that kind of model be the correct one for Christians? Some Christians say that's the only role that Christians should take. They should always have a critical, constructive role. And I want to suggest that that is a very unhistorical way of looking into the subject, of not considering different situations which might call for different approaches and participations. So this one would be adequate when you have reasons, you would have to explicit those reasons, when you would have reasons to say why you give support, why you give a chance for a given system. Because you think it is working basically, or has the potential at least of working basically all right for the best of the people, ensuring that the that justice is being fostered, the weak are protected, and so on. Those criteria we had yesterday of justice, life, liberation, and so on, these are being fostered and defended. But there are problems, there are places where you have to exercise the criticism to make it more effective, even better. If that is the case, then that is the model for a Christian participation. But then you would have to consider a second possibility under the critical participation, which we would call the critical passive, and let me put passive in quotation marks, passive resistance. The critical passive resistance. Well, what I mean by critical passive resistance is the following. Well, the critical instance is there. There is a system which is so perverted and so oppressive that, of course, you have to be critical to it, and even to the point of saying this system needs a drastic, a fundamental change. You cannot just improve it. You cannot just participate in a critical, constructive way. Let's say apartheid, South Africa. So, critical, constructive way of participating in, under apartheid? No, apartheid has to be abolished. That's such a perverted system that you cannot participate critically, constructively. But you have to choose for another model. It could be critical passive resistance. Passive comes in the sense, here in the very, very narrow sense really, that the conditions are so oppressive that you really cannot do anything actively to change that situation. You have to endure it without losing criticism, without accepting it, without taking it for granted, without falling under a certain fatalism. That's the way it is and it always will be. But really you have no means now, no ways of overcoming that system. Let's say slavery, centuries of slavery. Well, there were attempts of active transformation by blacks, few times by non-blacks, but blacks trying to flee and establish independent republics in Brazil. Actually, we had for over a century a sort of independent black republic. But that was rather an exception. In general, there were not the conditions, and even that experiment was then crushed down finally, but it lasted for 100 years. But most of the cases, there were not the conditions for really changing fundamentally that system. You could only work on hope for the future generations. And there, critical passive resistance is important, not to give the souls. That's much what the, as much as I can understand it, the Negro spirituals tell us about. You don't give the soul, you cannot change really the system yet, but the soul you don't give in. And you express it in other ways, singing, in liturgy, in cults. So you resist to it, but in a passive form. You have not found the ways of doing it actively. Now, the third form of critical participation would be then the critical active, and let me put active in quotation marks too, and I'm going to explain the quotation marks in a little while, critical active transformation. Well, again, you start from a point where you say the given system is so perverted, is so unjust, that you cannot participate in a critical, constructive way. Because even if you will improve a little bit here, a little bit there, but the great injustice of the system, you will be supporting. So those small improvements are not sufficient to meet the needs of people who are suffering under that huge system of exploitation, oppression, and so on. So you do need a fundamental transformation of the situation. And now you look for a way of doing it actively. And by the way, since last evening we had that dialogue on violence and nonviolence, the question we were talking is actually a question of this, of means of the third type. It's not that it would be a misunderstanding to say, well, nonviolence would be a critical passive resistance, because nonviolence, as Yoder was explaining, is not just a double negation, but is affirming something, and is also being active in transformation, but then refraining from the ultimate use of violence, which would kill other people. So the question of violence and nonviolence is a subtitle down the road of this third model of critical active transformation. Of course, you can use non-violent methods also in B and A, critical passive resistance and on critical constructive participation. Perhaps here and there you could even locally limited use violence on a critical constructive participation. That's another discussion, but in general it would have been a question to be discussed under the critical active transformation. What do we do? What can we do? What possibilities are there to overcome the system of oppression? And I will just suggest now a list, a small list, and then open for our dialogue, and perhaps open it then with a question of what do you think, what is the situation where you live in your country, which model is the more appropriate one for Christian participation in this country. But let me just suggest you a list of things out of my experience in Latin America, which will basically be the possibilities of what is called the people's organizations or people's movements, popular movements sometimes it's called there, which would be first base communities. Base communities was a space under the military dictatorships that grew as suddenly finding ways of being active in transformation, getting out of a situation of passive resistance because of not knowing how to change, and getting active. So moving from B to C, base communities is one example of that. But then vicinity groups, mothers of disappeared, in several countries in Latin America that has been one very strong example of critical active transformation. Mothers of those who have disappeared by the military in Argentina, in Guatemala. So getting together and raising concerns and protesting, setting up demonstrations, passing information, and so on. And human rights issues in general, many groups of human rights issues are example. Peasant leagues, the whole problem of land distribution in Latin America, and peasants and landless farmers getting organized and together, not dealing with these issues on a private manner anymore, but as a group. Well, other concern groups and unions, and when the political space is given of that opening, for example, after military regime changing into civilian rule, of organizing political parties too is a very fundamental question. Means, well, awareness building, sharing information, I mentioned already, letters of support and critique, pressure groups, financial support to concrete actions, and all these examples, of quite a few of them, all of them, you know, out of your own experience of possibilities, are all ways of participating actively. Well, either it could be just a chapter in a critical constructive participation, but it could also be a chapter in the critical active transformation. Well, okay. I think that's it for the moment. I might suggest that the way I see the Latin American situation of the vast majority of the countries, I personally feel that we cannot limit ourselves to the critical constructive participation. We have to look for a fundamental transformation of that system in Latin America. And under the military dictatorships, we were kind of proximate very often to the critical passive resistance as the possibility we had. More and more we moved into a stage of critical active transformation in various degrees. Well, okay, comments and so on, but I would also welcome a reflection on what is the U.S. scenery and participation of Christians.
You spoke of the South African example, and it would seem to me that South Africa would be one of the easier places to select how you're to function, due to the fact that if you move to too many of these areas, you're going to be dead or imprisoned forever, like Mandela or something like that. But the approach that I think would be correct for most people would be a critical passive resistance if they were South African citizens. How do you feel on that?
Well, let me say first the example of South Africa and whether the passive model of a critical passive resistance would be the best one there. I do think somehow, at some stage, there must be a movement out of B, of the critical passive resistance, into the critical active transformation. That might take generations sometimes. So for an individual, it might represent that the only thing he or she can do is to stick to that model of passive resistance, critical passive resistance, so not giving in the soul, but resisting. Now, I think, as much as I can see, I've never been there, but listening, people who live there, people who have come out from there, and reading and so on, I think the South African situation has moved already from B to C.
Well, like Tutu can, he's at C, and yeah. Mandela's wife would be at C.
And probably, and Mandela himself is now suffering at this moment because he became active, even in a very peaceful way, active. So many choose, non-violent means, but of active, looking for active transformation, and are imprisoned or are disappeared, but they are in prison, repression at this very moment. They function perhaps as, and very powerfully so, as a symbol, but directly they cannot do much. Indirectly they might be doing very much. So in one sense you could perhaps say that the absolute passive example does not exist, because at least potentially it is present there, when you deny support, even if it's only within yourself, in your conscience and so on, there is the potential of coming out. And when it does come out, then it is already something active. So the absolute pacifism in that sense probably does not exist. But I don't know, I probably went around your question. I do think that at a certain stage, blacks in South Africa just suffered their situation. And probably many still are in that situation, that they only are suffering it and don't know how to be active. But in general, I think the whole trend, you can feel that it's becoming more and more active, looking for a transformation of that society, and perhaps even more and more radical because of the escalation also of repression.
But that is not for to have a critical passive resistance. It's not necessary that some people have an active participation.
Well, that's a good point too, I think, some people will be active, and so others become conscious of the situation, even if they don't see what to do. And so the suffering which they accepted as a kind of fatalism up to a certain moment, suddenly they see, well, we are suffering because of injustice and not because it is the will of God. So that is a very dramatic and important change in the consciousness of people, and I think it's brought up very often, at least, by those who are active in some way, somewhere, and it becomes known. But I think there are also some forms of expressing that passive resistance which are not really conscious. I think much of what the religious expressions, for example, and the songs and so on, they are conscious in the sense that they are expressed, but they are not reflected logically in that sense. But they express the feelings, and in expressing the feelings, they are resisting. And very often, I think people who become active draw out of that expression of feelings of the people. Suddenly they, at a certain moment, are able to express that into logical, systematic words, and are able to express it in concrete action. But they draw out of something which is present already in the community. So probably it moves both ways, I think. And
I'm just a little bit confused about how choosing a critical active transformation role would tie into what you're talking about yesterday with church and state. If we chose that role and worked towards a transformation, holding in mind the values that you quoted Luther as pointing out for the state, like defending the weak and the oppressed, what sort of synthesis of church and state would that transformation be leading to? Wouldn't it be one of more a church dominance?
Well, could, but I don't think it must. So if I understood your question right, is, well, the church criticizes the state and takes a role as a critical active transformation model, and let's now look, let's say it is successful somehow in society, and the and the society changes. Is it then a society which will be a new model of Christendom, where the church dominates over against the society? Well, it could be if the church sponsors by itself the alternative model. The church knows what to do. And I'm not so convinced of that. I think the church, rightly so, can criticize better than propose alternatives. I think that's not, very often it's said, well, you criticize so much and you don't know what to do. I think that's actually a pretty good role for the church. Otherwise they would kind of be the owners of the perfect model and then try to establish it if they have the means. So I would kind of propose that the church, alongside with others outside of the church too, would exercise a critical role, and then the people organized will be finding the way of establishing a better society. And if then the church says, well, that what has come out is a better model and we see so many good things and so on, at least we have to give a chance and so on, the church would be moving to the critical constructive participation, but would not be the owner of the system, and then have to defend it as if it were the kingdom of God against those who are against the kingdom of God. Does that go in the direction of your question?
Yeah, that answers it. I guess I'm still just a little bit confused about yesterday, your suggestions yesterday, because you included the alliance of church and state under adaptation, and then you ruled that out today, and then I thought yesterday that's what you were suggesting.
Oh, no. Actually, I was misunderstood. It was the first session, and I was yesterday kind of saying both models, separation and alliance, are not good, are not good models. And we have to have a model which will have both. We'll have a distinction. That's the correct side of the model of separation of church and state. We have to distinguish both, and at the same time, we have to relate both. So the separation cannot be absolute, it must be a distinction, but you have to relate it in a certain tension, which will be stronger or smaller, but always will be some tension. That is a more complicated model that I was trying to suggest.
So that when you separate church and state, it's only the bad part of that separation only comes when you find that you cannot be an active part of both because they don't hold the same values?
Well, I think the separation as such is bad for a number of reasons, but if you say that the person would be moving back and forth from one place to the other, have one type of living on Sunday and the other type of living during the week and so on, and you have to in some way relate the two. The other one is that you lose the critical the critical potential. If you just separate, you accept it, and you get to, you are happy with your own private life and devotion and so on, and you leave the other one. You might perhaps personally move and then you do something else there, what you have not been doing here, and so you live a kind of two lives. But if you want to have some integrity in your own life and just one, you have to relate state and church in a different way, and you have to have the claim that out of faith you are saying something to the public, public order. As also the public order limits the church as institution, property, and other aspects. So again, there is also a relation from the state towards the church. David?
This is an observation that may find its way into a question, but in my community and in my church, it feels as if we are good at using the active, critical active transformation method to be critical about our local government. Businesses in our neighborhood, county-wide or city-wide government practices, policies. When you start moving away, even as big as the county or state especially, we become much less active, and then you get to a national level, and it feels like our people feel much less powerful, or maybe even powerless. And it doesn't appear that our church members see themselves as connected with others in a significant way to be critically, actively transforming the system, the larger system of government, the federal system of government, we might call it. And it feels for me difficult to move in that direction because of that perceived powerlessness. It feels much easier to protest in our neighborhood, to be active in that realm.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's a very, very good comment on. I think the tape probably got it. I don't have to repeat it. Would you join in that? I was actually proposing that you bring about some reflections on U.S. and that's one of them. Yes, please.
Well, I've always been quite happy to have the state lay off of any church systems. But on the other hand, I really am disappointed, like, on issues of disarmament or reduction of missiles. I don't know how all churches, and this really is not even the Lutheran Church, but personally, if we want to have a meeting 2 years ago on reduction of missiles, that was too political to announce at church. If we wanted to use one of the rooms in church to group meet on forming a community starting reduction of missiles. Now this is 2 years ago, so it's probably a little more liberal. That was not, because it would be printed in the paper that church had a group meeting there concerned with reduction of missiles. And there's a lot of the congregation that maybe want more atomic bombs. And so those kind of issues I've been disappointed on, but yet I'm asking I want my cake and eat it too, you know. I don't want the state to affect us, but I want to affect the state. So I don't know, that's kind of open too. Is this still what's happening in the United States? Are churches associating with these kinds of issues? Severe ecology problems?
Well, I think that probably it's the deep rootedness of the separation of church and state model, which brings about that kind of situation, because if you would kind of look theologically to it, why shouldn't Christians be concerned about nuclear armaments? Well, there's really no theological reason for not. But the system of separation of church is so well established, so strong, that it becomes difficult for Christians to reflect as Christians on it and say, well, let's leave it for the politicians. They will do it okay. We can participate as private citizens there, but not the church. So. Yes?
To move from the tangible, the local problems that we have, I think we all find those problems very hard to deal with, like to get into the state issues and the federal issues. And I myself have been wrestling with that problem and tend to almost want to give up sometimes, because it's so hard to keep people alive in dealing with those problems, but some of the things that I've seen here, like the letter writing process that they had, has given me some ideas to take back to deal with. And a doctor that I talked to gave me a point: when you're dealing with things that are less tangible, you must have faith. You must have faith that if you write a letter to somebody, that maybe the Spirit of God will use your letter to inspire them to take a Christian position. And so therefore, if you deal with that position that way, a less tangible position, you can keep people involved. And one of the things we tend to do now is, when we sit down on letter writing, I belong to Bread for the World, we sit down and we write a letter together. And that, to me, has helped us out a lot. But one of the things I've seen here that we didn't implement where I was is those of us who were leading were kind of setting up the things that we were writing letters on. We picked the thing. And what I saw is here, they had a list of maybe 10 or 12 things. And they didn't force people, or they didn't try to brainwash people to take a specific position. What they did was present issues and allowed somebody even to take a position, which was, we want more bombs, we want more nuclear involvement. But it at least got people thinking and taking positions. And these ideas I'm going to try to carry back. But you must have faith, and I think that's the one thing that we don't have to have too much of when we're dealing with tangible issues. That God's involved in our one letter or our 10 letters that we're sending out, and that nothing's really going to occur anyway unless God's the one who's inspiring us to get these things done. If we're flow-throughs for God to act, then it's much more valuable than if we overpower society with our letters, if you understand what I'm saying.
Practically, it feels like motivation is somewhat of an issue. We've had letter writing days that say have produced 60 letters in the Bread for the World Hunger Legislation kind of effort. But we do that maybe once or twice a year, and yet we'll go down to Honeywell and protest maybe every week or every month. That seems much easier to keep momentum going for than for the national, federal legislation.
Why can't you have a letter writing group once a month or something?
Oh, sure. No, we could. I'm just making the observation that it feels easier to be operating on a local level where we feel we see results or feel we have more influence. And you're right, I think it does take
effective too.
What's that?
It's probably more effective too, I would think.
Well, it appears more effective, but you can get a lot done on a couple of letters at a national level. If you can impact on one bill, for example, a $50 million bill or a $150 million bill, the impact of a $150 million bill for the International Fund for Agriculture Development can have a tremendous impact, let's say in Africa. And all the charity of all the Christian organizations in the country can have that kind of impact.
Jody, and then over there, and probably then we would have kind of closed. I would make some final remarks too.
I was thinking about the challenge you're laying before us and some of David's reflections on the question of how in the world you relate national to local. What is the problem here? It seems to me that partly the problem is that much more than in your part of the world, we are, in the United States anyway, sort of militantly ahistorical, right? We have not very much, not just in the sense that we don't know our own past, but that we don't feel ourselves to be a part of history. We don't feel ourselves to be part of larger realities, right? Whether national, social movements, and so on. Once we begin to think about what are the larger movements, what are the larger currents in the society which carry us through history into change, then it seems to me your questions become rich and interesting from my point of view. For instance, one of the pieces of history, it seems to me, in our kind of culture is that there are lots of examples of groups in the United States in the 20th century starting out at point C, right, and sort of being sucked into point A, if not all the way up to adaptation, right? That the rule here, if you're talking about marginalized people, people at the bottom of the society or at the edges of the society, the rule is, in fact, that militant groups get absorbed into the framework of the existing institutions. It certainly has happened to the labor movement over and over again. It's happened to various branches of the civil rights movement, and to a variety of other, movements that have originally really raised critical, fundamental questions about the system. Some writers have talked about this as some kind of a phenomenon of repressive tolerance, right? That the system tolerates so much that it's repressive, that it can absorb almost anything anybody says about it and almost anything anybody can do about it, which is a little bit different, it seems to me, probably from the situation in most third world countries, and puts us into a much more problematic relationship with the question of what do we do under your second category? What is critical participation in this kind of a culture?
Yeah, well,
that's a rich set of questions.
That's very interesting. Yes?
I guess I was feeling like maybe the church needs to take a more educative role, that the need for us to go to our state and federal with many of our problems, I think, is essential, but I don't think people oftentimes see the connection. That it's easy to bring food to the church for the food bank or old clothes or something, to actually see the reason that people are going hungry, that there's an increasing hunger, that there's an increasing homelessness. And I think we don't, first of all, it's not the thing we most want to hear. It shakes our lives if we have to hear what the reasons are. But I think that's where the church needs to be willing to step in and get people feeling a little uncomfortable, helping them to understand that they need to go beyond bringing in a can of food. And, perhaps then we can get more people writing letters, or we can get more people finding a way to be active. But until the problem is identified, then we can't hope for much.
The question on that is, where should this kind of change take place at? At the local level, that's where it seems to generate. But really, it has to happen in the hierarchical level, and that's not—it's not happening there.
Yeah.
Well, okay. That's good. My final comment would also be on that kind of relation of the local initiative and the global system. I think what David pointed out is certainly, as much as I can see, one element of you feel kind of powerless in front of the big. Structure, and here you have a place where you can act, and that's psychologically very important. You have to have a place where you can do something. That's the experience of the base communities too. They didn't start with a huge society. That didn't work. They started with, well, we need water right here, but I think, I don't know, I might be mistaken, I think there is a second element, especially in the United States too. If you can stick to the local realm, then you don't have to challenge the big system. That means you don't have to challenge your own identity. I think the American system has been so successful, and most Americans are really proud of it. It's a part of it. So. The very fact of thinking about the possibility of a challenge to the global system is very threatening. It puts the question what you are, your history, your identity, and so there could be a sort of danger also of, well, let's just stay here, that's where we can do something, and so on, and leave the other one untouched. Or if the criticism is more radical, then it will be absorbed some way. I would think that it's important, and probably there is the potential of moving the other way, from the small initiative into larger areas, connecting initiative groups and national networks and so on, very necessary. So to build from the small experience and enlarge it to nation-wide, counter movement, I think, is very important to build up.